I am Neo. Welcome into the Skeptic Arena. Today is December 13th, 2009. The website is theskepticarena.com. Today's topic is entitled A Dispensation to Cause Pain. The ritual slaughter of animals decreed by Jewish and Muslim dietary laws require that the animals are conscious when they have their throats slit. My comment, that's probably not any different than when Jews and Muslims used to practice human sacrifice. The article continues. In the European secular food industry, regulations strive to minimize the risk of causing pain, fear, or distress to the animals in their being slaughtered for food. My reply, those would be the civilized human beings. The article goes on, crucially, these rules require the stunning of animals before being killed, either with a bolt to the brain or with electricity. However, the law kowtows before the Jewish Kashrut and Islamic halal guidelines in permitting the avoidance of stunning. My comment, religious believers will continue to force modern civilizations to kowtow to their brutal inhuman practices until society finds the courage to stand up to them. We stop them from practicing human sacrifice. Hopefully, we can do the same for animals. Article continues. This week, New Zealand veterinarian scientist Craig Johnson was given an award from the Humane Slaughter Association for his body of work that demonstrates that animals suffer more without stunning. My comment, we needed a study to know that. It continues, in one crucial experiment, Johnson administered mild anesthetics to calves so that they could not feel the pain of the incision. But the pain response was still measurable. It remained present in the animals without stunning, but was immediately erased by stunning. I think our work is the best evidence yet that it is painful, Johnson told New Scientist. While this may appear to come from the oft-referenced University of the Bleeding Obvious, in fact, defenders of Jewish Shishita and Muslim Dabiya slaughter cite scientific evidence that the practice is not painful to the animal. I comment, they also cite scientific evidence that the world is 6,000 years old and that humans played with dinosaurs, so I wouldn't put too much faith in any evidence they offer about anything. They continue, in 2003, the Muslim Council of Great Britain claimed that the brain is instantaneously starved of blood and there is no time to start feeling any pain. Johnson's work says otherwise. My comment, maybe that's how they justify stoning people to death. They continue, if we, as the dominant species on Earth, are to use and consume animals, it is our duty to minimize their suffering in doing so. In scientific and medical research, animal work is extremely tightly regulated according to very specific rules designed to minimize suffering. Animal research is expensive, time-consuming, and unpleasant. I have never met a scientist who relishes it. This is an important point in arguing with those who oppose the use of animals in scientific research. Some organizations campaign for the use of alternatives, such as cell cultures. In my experience, almost all scientists involved in research which requires animals will tell you that where alternatives are available that can provide as good data, they will use them. But more often than not, the use of animals produces more informative data. However distasteful the experiments may be, the benefits outweigh the costs. He continues, I eat meat. I find this position much harder to justify than my continued support for animal research. I recognize that there are many people who oppose both meat eating and scientific research on animals, and for the less fanatical, these arguments can be sophisticated and nuanced. Even so, opponents should surely recognize the ethics of our civilized society go some way to minimize suffering in both of these endeavors. And yet, at the very same time, we still offer special dispensation to the religious so that ancient and arbitrary customs can be upheld. My comment, actually, they demand dispensation or they will threaten violence. He continues, neither Shishita or Dabia are described in religious texts, the Torah and the Quran. They derive from oral histories and traditional practices. My comment, so in other words, this is all based on the opinion of some ancient goat herder. They continue, some Jewish or Muslim butchers do indeed perform the stun before the cut. It's time to recognize that without the stun, these practices cannot be justified scientifically. They are acts of avoidable cruelty predicated on anachronistic beliefs. While they may be part of a way of life, our ethics insists that they need to be modified. Johnson received his gong from the HSA for work which, according to New Scientist, strengthens the case for adapting the practices to make them more humane. More precisely, I would think that to a reasonable person, it suggests that the anachronism of slaughter without stunning has no place in the modern world and should be outlawed. This special indulgence to religious practices should be replaced with the evidence-based approaches to which the rest of us are subject. My final comment. If all special indulgences to religious practices could be stopped, the benefit to humanity would be incalculable. And now we move to the science segment. Artie Fossil sheds light on origin of human species. Artie lived 4.4 million years ago in the woodlands of East Africa. She spent most of her time in the trees. She stood about 4 feet tall, weighed 110 pounds, and had long arms and short legs, and a grasping big toe that was perfect for clambering branch to branch. She ate in the trees, raised her offspring in the trees, and slept in the trees. But sometimes she came down to the ground and stood upright. She could walk on two legs. She was, in a sense, taking baby steps on a journey that would change the world. Artie is the nickname given to a remarkable, shattered skeleton that an international team of scientists believes is a major breakthrough in the study of human origins. The skeletal remains were painstakingly recovered from the Ethiopian desert, along with bones from at least 35 other members of a species scientists call Ardipithecus ramidus. The 15-year investigation of Ardipithecus culminated Thursday in the publication of a raft of papers in the online edition of the journal Science, as well as dual press conferences in Washington and Addis Ababa, Ethiopia. This is huge. This is the biggest discovery, really, since the Lucy skeleton of the 1970s, said Carol Ward, a University of Missouri paleoanthropologist who was not involved with the research but had been given a preview so that she could offer an independent assessment. Human origins is a field with high stakes and small bones, and the elaborate rollout of the Ardipithecus research probably will trigger debate about the message contained in fossils, so fragile they had to be excavated with dental picks and porcupine quills. If the scientists who found Artie are correct, she represents a transitional figure, almost a hybrid, a tree creature who could carry food in her arms as she explored the woodland floor on two legs. Artie lived more than 1 million years before Lucy, the name given to the 3.2 million-year-old skeleton found in 1974 that is the best example of Australopithecus afarensis, a small-brained primate that had fully adapted to bipedal life and had expanded its habitat beyond the forest into the savanna of Africa. Unlike Artie, she lacked the grasping big toe that extends laterally from the foot. Lucy's big toe pointed forward, aligned with the other toes, and was used for propulsion. Artie and Lucy had different teeth, with Lucy's enlarged molars more adapted to a wide-ranging diet on the savanna. But Artie and Lucy had rather similar faces, skulls, hands, and pelvises. The scientists who found Artie do not contend that Artie necessarily evolved into Lucy, or that Ardipithecus ramidus was necessarily a direct human ancestor. The human family of primates could have splintered into multiple species along the way, with some winding up as genetic dead ends. If that were the case, Artie would be more of a distant cousin to human beings rather than a direct forebearer. Tim White asked, the individual Artie, that female individual, is she our ancestor? The answer is probably not. If she didn't have any kids, tough luck. She's nobody's ancestor. The Artie team, however, does make the case that the genus Ardipithecus, which could have encompassed a number of species, is ancestral to the genus Australopithecus. Thus, the general body plan of Artie would evolve into the general body plan of Lucy, and on down the line until the genus Homo appears. The Ardipithecus genus gave rise to Australopithecus, even though we can't say exactly what species did. Maybe Ramidus did, but certainly something like Ramidus did. White and colleagues found the first signs of Ardipithecus in 1994 in what is known as the Middle Awash, a treeless desert that 4 million years ago would have been much wetter, teeming with birds, reptiles, primates, and thickly covered with fig and palm trees. A key moment came November 5, 1994, when a Berkeley graduate student, Johannes Haile Selassie of Ethiopia, found fragments of two finger bones. Further digging turned up scraps of a pelvis, feet, hands, and chips from a skull. By January, the scientists realized they had found a paleontological treasure, a partial skeleton broken up and ravaged by time. This was Artie. The scientists found scores of other specimens, from both males and females, though the bones were for the most part scattered and isolated. Although Ardipithecus quickly entered the paleontology lexicon in the mid-1990s, the scientists knew that this was potentially a major discovery. It was not until Thursday, after some complaints by fellow scientists over how long the process was taking, that White and his colleagues produced a detailed description of the species. Artie tells us twice as much as Lucy did. We have hands and feet, a more complete environment, a more complete skeleton. It's older, it's more primitive. It shows us the process of transformation from common ancestor to hominid. The origin of the human species via evolution from earlier primates is beyond scientific dispute. Even when the fossil record of Africa was virtually non-existent, Charles Darwin argued that human beings probably evolved from African primates. Fieldwork over the past century confirmed Darwin's hypothesis, which was bolstered further by laboratory analysis of the genetic codes of humans, chimpanzees, and other primates. The fine details of human origin, however, have become sketchier and more subject to interpretation and debate as the researchers dig deeper into the past and the fossils become scarcer, more fragmentary, and in many cases more enigmatic. Scientists continue to search for the last common ancestor, sometimes abbreviated as the LCA. This is the creature to which both modern humans and modern chimpanzees can trace their ancestry. Many scientists believe the common ancestor lived about 7 million years ago. The new research on Artie suggests that this ancestor didn't look nearly as much like modern chimpanzees as had previously been suspected. Rather, the ancestor would have looked more like Ardipithecus. This suggests that chimpanzees, far from being time machines for visiting the distant past, have themselves evolved significantly, including developing such skills as suspending from branches and knuckle walking. The common ancestor looked like Artie. It's the chimp and gorilla that have evolved enormously, not hominids. Hominids have concentrated their evolution in two things, upright walking and brain. Everything else is pretty primitive. In the Ardipithecus genus, the males are not significantly different in size from the females. The males also lack the dagger-like teeth that male chimps use to fight one another for access to ovulating females. Lovejoy argues that this is a sign of a different social organization. The males, he argues, pair-bonded with females and supplied them with food. the upright walking would have made food transport easier. Lovejoy sees male parental investment in the survival of offspring as a hallmark of the human lineage. The road to becoming human didn't start with a big brain. The road to becoming human began with setting the social conditions that would allow for the expansion of the big brain. Andrew Hill, a Yale anthropologist, said he didn't think there was enough evidence to support Lovejoy's conclusions about the domestic relations of male and female Ardipithecines. But, he said, the newly described hominid is a very satisfactory animal that reinforces the accumulating evidence that these things probably evolved and really lived in woodland conditions rather than savannas. David Pilbeam, a Harvard paleontologist, noted that there has been some impatience in the scientific community as White and his team conducted the Ardipithecus analysis, but he suggested that the wait was worth it. This is an extraordinary achievement of discovery, recovery, reconstitution, description, and analysis, which will keep many others busy for at least another 15 years. Artie did not look like a human by any stretch. She had a small head relative to her body size. There is no way to read her mind and measure her sense of self or her awareness of her place in the universe. But if the scientists are correct, her path in life proved to be fruitful over time, and the planet witnessed the rise of a new animal that could run on two legs, invent tools, tame fire, and perhaps eventually, with much digging and scraping, decipher its own origin. And now we move to the religion segment. The Center for Inquiry releases a statement from Eben Warrick in response to the Fort Hood tragedy. Denying reality, or the heavy cost of political correctness. In the wake of the murder of 13 and the wounding of 38 soldiers at Fort Hood on November 5th, media analysts, politicians, and other sundry experts scrambled to present the accused perpetrator of the acts, Major Nidal Malik Hassan, age 39, as a victim. In so doing, they served knowingly or otherwise as apologists for radical Islam. From CNN to the New York Times, NPR to the Washington Post, the killings were presented as a result of racism. They were attributed to fear of deployment in Afghanistan and harassment from other soldiers. Cited were Major Hassan's supposed maladjustment to his life and his sense of not belonging, pre-traumatic stress disorder, and various personal and mental problems. All these explanations are variations on what I have called the root cause fallacy, which has been committed time and again since the terrorist acts of September 11, 2001. The root cause fallacy was designed to deflect attention away from Islam, in effect to exonerate Islam, which we are told is never to blame for acts of violence. On this view, we must not hold a great world religion of peace responsible when individuals of that faith resort to force. We must dig deeper. The real cause is poverty, U.S. foreign policy, the Arab-Israeli conflict, Western colonialism and exploitation, marital problems of individuals, and so on. The present psychological interpretations in the case of Major Hassan are just the latest example of the root cause fallacy at work. The paper, The Australian, tells us that the mindset of Major Hassan remains a mystery, yet his jihadist intentions are there on the surface for everyone not paralyzed by political correctness to see. According to CNN on November 7th, on the morning of the shootings, Hassan gave copies of the Quran to his neighbors. According to the Associated Press on November 6th, soldiers reported that Hassan shouted out, "Allahu Akbar," which means God is great, the war cry of all jihadists, before firing off over 100 rounds with two pistols in a center where some 300 unarmed soldiers had lined up for vaccines and eye tests. NPR informs us that Hassan was put on probation early in his postgraduate work at the Uniformed Service University of the Health Sciences in Bethesda, Maryland, for proselytizing about his Muslim faith with patients and colleagues. The Associated Press on November 11th adds that classmates who studied with Hassan from that postgraduate program reported Hassan making a presentation during their studies that justified suicide bombing and spewed anti-American propaganda, denouncing the war on terror as a war against Islam. Classmate Val Finnell and another student complained about Hassan, shocked that someone with this type of vile ideology would be allowed to wear an officer's uniform. But importantly, no one filed a formal complaint about Hassan's views and comments for fear of appearing discriminatory, in other words, out of political correctness. According to The Telegraph, on November 6th, Army colleagues reported that Major Hassan had condemned U.S. foreign policy, that he clearly declared that Muslims had the right to rise up and attack Americans, that he expressed happiness when a U.S. soldier was killed in an attack on a military recruitment center in Arkansas in June, and that he said some people should strap bombs on themselves and go to Times Square. It has been widely reported that Major Hassan attended the Dar al-Hijra Mosque in Virginia Falls during the time that Anwar al-Awlaki, a Yemen-based al-Qaeda preacher with extensive terrorist connections, was its main preacher. Awlaki even praised Major Hassan as a hero on November 9th, 4 days after the Fort Hood attacks. The Times of London revealed on November 10th that Major Hassan had been in direct correspondence with Awlaki, in connection with which Hassan had already been under investigation by the FBI. Almost every news source has reported that Major Hassan was also under investigation by federal law enforcement officials for his postings to an internet site speaking favorably of suicide bombing. Fortunately, not all in the media were hamstrung by political correctness. Here is Ralph Peters in the New York Post on November 6th. On Thursday afternoon, a radicalized Muslim U.S. Army officer shouting Allahu Akbar committed the worst act of terror on American soil since 9/11. And no one wants to call it an act of terror or associate it with Islam. What cowards we are. Political correctness killed those patriotic Americans at Fort Hood as surely as the Islamist gunmen did. And the media treat it like a case of non-denominational shoplifting. This was a terrorist act. When an extremist plans and executes a murderous plot against our unarmed soldiers to protest our efforts to counter Islamist fanatics, it is an act of terror, period. There was a laudable concern among Americans about a possible backlash against all American Muslims. What backlash? Even following the September 11 attacks, with their 2,976 victims, Americans behaved with exemplary restraint. They behaved in a civilized manner in the face of barbarism. It is time to abandon apologetics and political correctness. Not all Muslims are terrorists. Not all Muslims are implicated in the horrendous events of September 11, 2001, or of November 5, 2009. However, to pretend that Islam has nothing to do with 9/11 or the Fort Hood massacre is willfully to ignore the obvious. To leave Islam out of the equation means to forever misinterpret events. Without Islam, the long-term strategy and individual acts of violence by Osama bin Laden and his followers make little sense. Without Islam, the West will go on being incapable of understanding our terrorist enemies, and hence will be incapable to deal with them. Without Islam, neither is it possible to comprehend the barbarism of the Taliban, the position of women and non-Muslims in Islamic countries, or now the murders attributed to Major Hassan. We are confronted, after all, with Islamic terrorists, and we must take the Islamic component seriously. Westerners in general, and Americans in particular, no longer seem to be able to grasp the passionate religious convictions of Islamic terrorists. It is this passionate conviction directed against the West and against non-Muslims in general that drives them. They are truly and literally God-intoxicated fanatics. If we refuse to understand that, we cannot understand them. Jihad is a religious war with those who are unbelievers in the mission of Muhammad. It is an incumbent religious duty, established in the Quran and in the traditions as a divine institution, and enjoined specially for the purpose of advancing Islam and repelling evil from Muslims. That is how it is described in no lesser source than the Dictionary of Islam. So we should not pretend surprise if Islamic terrorists see their mission in such terms. In the wake of the Fort Hood massacre, America's armed forces, the FBI, CIA, Department of Homeland Security, and other counterterrorist bodies faced some difficult decisions about Muslims employed in their services. After all, the view Major Hassan expressed, that Muslims in the U.S. armed forces should not serve in Iraq or Afghanistan, or any place where they might have to kill fellow Muslims, is precisely in keeping with fatwas issued by such Muslim leaders as Ali Guma, the Mufti of Egypt, which forbade Muslim soldiers to take part in the so-called war on terror. When Muslim soldiers or agents or operatives feel that their primary allegiance is to Islam and not the United States, can we safely allow their service to continue? It is an agonizing question, but one which we must confront. However, we cannot properly confront this question while we struggle to pretend that Islam itself is not part of the dispute. Eban Warwick is a senior research fellow at the Center for Inquiry and author of 5 books, including Why I Am Not a Muslim and Defending the West, both published by Prometheus Books. And now for the final segment of the show, Famous Quotes. Today, Michael Shermer, born in 1954, he is 55 years old. Michael Shermer is an American science writer, historian of science, and founder of the Skeptic Society, and editor-in-chief of its magazine, Skeptic, which is largely devoted to investigating and debunking pseudoscientific and supernatural claims. The Skeptic Society currently has over 55,000 members. Shermer is also the producer and co-host of the 13-hour Fox Family television series, Exploring the Unknown. Since April of 2004, he has been a monthly columnist for the Scientific American magazine with his Skeptic column. Shermer claims to have once been a fundamentalist Christian, but converted from belief in God during his graduate studies. And now for the quotes from Michael Shermer. A Hubble Space Telescope photograph of the universe evokes far more awe for creation than light streaming through a stained glass window in a cathedral. His next quote, every 6 hours I would force down a huge handful of assorted vitamins and minerals. Their taste and smell nearly made me sick, and they went right through me, producing what I thought had to be the most expensive and colorful urine in America. Next, magician James Randi is fond of lampooning authorities with PhDs. Once they are granted the degree, he says, they find it almost impossible to say two things. I don't know, and I was wrong. His next quote, evolution no more breaks the second law of thermodynamics than one breaks the law of gravity by jumping up. His next quote, being tolerant when you are in the majority means you have a greater chance of being tolerated when you are in the minority. And the final quote from Michael Shermer, smart people believe weird things because they are skilled at defending beliefs they arrived at for non-smart reasons.
Are you ready, Goose?